here with us for the morning show as we unpack the big tech antitrust hearings this week. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, the CEOs of Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Google. They were in the virtual hot seat for nearly a six-hour congressional antitrust hearing that probed the power these companies have and how they deal with competition. Observers say that it sets the stage for bigger government investigations into their business practices. Here's House Judiciary Chair David Cicilline of Rhode Island.
Many of the practices used by these companies have harmful economic effects. They discourage entrepreneurship, destroy jobs, hike costs, and degrade quality. Simply put, they have too much power.
Did you follow the hearings? What are your takeaways? We're at 800-642-1234. Julia Angwin is an investigative journalist and editor-in-chief of The Markup. It's a nonprofit newsroom that investigates the impacts of technology on society. Julia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here.
So House lawmakers who called this hearing, they've been investigating these companies for over a year now. And this week, we kind of got a feel for what they've learned from all of their document gathering and their interviews. So what is it that they are looking for? Help us understand this case.
Yeah, this was a really historic hearing. I mean, there's never been a time where the four CEOs of the biggest tech companies have appeared. And what we saw in the hearing was that the lawmakers were really serious. Like they were, the questions were extremely aggressive and contentious from both sides of the aisle. And it seems like they're laying the groundwork for some pretty strong recommendations. I wouldn't be surprised if they ask for a breakup of some of these companies or really strong regulations. Worth pointing out, though, that for when it comes to antitrust enforcement, the ball is really in the court of the Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission. And so Congress will make recommendations, but then law enforcement agencies would have to enforce those. So that's also the state attorneys general who are also doing their own antitrust investigations.
Jeff Bezos of Amazon, he was the big get of the hearing, first appearance before Congress of the world's richest person. How did he conduct himself?
Yeah, it was interesting to see Jeff Bezos testify as his first appearance. It reminded me of the first time that Mark Zuckerberg testified. It was a little less polished than the others. And you can tell that he, you know, he's the richest man in the world. He's not used to having people challenge him. So he did look a little taken aback when the lawmakers, for instance, played a recording of a Amazon seller talking about how poorly she felt she'd been treated by the company. And, you know, he was, I think he looked a little shocked.
So how did he defend himself in those situations? Because, you know, these smaller sellers and third-party sellers are really concerned about being compromised by the giant Amazon. How did he defend himself?
Well, I mean, the truth is his defense was, and most of these companies' defense was, like, you know, that overall they are a benefit to society, right? That he's created all these jobs because there were never jobs being Amazon sellers before, and that, like, it, you know, this tide lifts all boats, and that, you know, these examples that lawmakers brought forward, he sort of described as outliers or possibly mistakes, and that he was looking into them. And so, you know, the argument is that overall we're a benefit to society.
So Google has made the internet more usable. Amazon has made shopping easier, a lifeline, huge marketplace. Why does it matter that these big companies, if they are, you know, have so much power, and if we're benefiting from what they offer? Where is the rub here?
Yeah, I mean, that really is the key question that all antitrust enforcers are facing, which is the idea of antitrust is historically focused on consumer harm. And so the idea is, like, right now, we are benefiting from Google as a free service, Facebook's free service, right? Amazon, pretty low prices most of the time. And so you do feel like, as a consumer, the harm is hard to prove. But there's another theory of antitrust enforcement, which is about harm to competitors. And there you really have a case to be made, which is that there are, you know, retail businesses, for sure, there's documented evidence that many, Amazon has harmed many of that sector. And then you have Google, where there was allegations that they are crushing other content providers because they put their results higher up, like, for example, Yelp. has had a case against them for a long time for this. And so, and similarly, Apple with, you know, its draconian and confusing rules for getting into the App Store. So all of these companies, there are charges being made that they are harming the competition and the field. And what that means is in the long run, if there are fewer competitors, it does mean eventually there probably will be consumer harm because they will drop, once they don't have competition, they can charge us whatever they want.
We're talking with Julia Angwin, who is an investigative journalist covering technology and its role in society. We're exploring the congressional antitrust hearing this week involving big tech CEOs from Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Getting your thoughts on the hearing, did you watch them or listen to them? What did you think about? Are tech companies too big to fail? Are they stifling innovation by squashing or buying up their competitors? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Julia, let's look further here at Google. Your reporting showed that when we do a Google search, many of the links on the first page of results are to Google's own sites that they control. It was brought up during the hearing. What did you find?
Yeah, we went and looked really in depth at something that probably a lot of people who use Google have noticed, which is more and more when you do a search, you see a bunch of boxes with answers to your search or related or suggestions for related searches. And it's quite far down the page when you finally see a link to an external site. So we decided to try to measure that. And it involved scraping the results for 15,000 searches and analyzing those pages. And what we found was that Google does give itself quite an advantage. It takes up 40% of the search results entirely, if you think of the whole page of results before you have to click the like next page button. And when you look at the first screen, if you're doing the search on mobile, which most people do, the first screen of results before you scroll, Google gives itself 63% of that page. And so that is a lot of advantage that they've given themselves with their platform.
And so that translates into ad revenue.
Yeah, it translates into ad revenue because those are properties that they own. And also it means that advertisers are more likely to just buy ads on Google search instead of on the websites that Google search would send you to. And so they advantage themselves lots of different ways.
So when the hearing, you know, turned toward the questions about anti-conservative bias, what were Republican lawmakers probing there? Because it really was deviating from the thrust of the hearing about competition.
Yeah, many of the Republican questions were not really tied directly to antitrust, right? This question of whether conservative voices are being unfairly banned or not promoted on these social networks is not necessarily an antitrust question, but it's something that a lot of the lawmakers raised. The thing that's strange about it is that at the very moment that they, you know, one of the lawmakers was sort of haranguing Facebook for removing a video that really spread untruths about coronavirus and saying that, oh, you know, conservative voices are being shut down, there was data being released showing that the top 10 news sites on Facebook, 9 out of 10 of them are conservative. And so the evidence doesn't really support this idea that conservative voices are being suppressed, at least on Facebook. And so, but yet there were lots of anecdotes raised during the hearing.
We have Julia Angwin, editor-in-chief of The Markup, and she's breaking down the congressional antitrust hearing this week. You can join in. How do you view big tech? Are you worried about misconduct and how these companies handle user data? Is it their size pertaining to competition and domination? Do you have another area of concern? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're getting takeaways from the congressional antitrust hearing this week. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CEOs of the four largest tech companies were grilled by lawmakers in a wide-ranging hearing. They probed whether these companies' size and power is bad for competition and the consumers who use their products the world over. Facebook and Google face questions on whether they have an anti-conservative bias, as we've been talking about. Apple was challenged on App Store policies. Amazon got grilled on how it treats small sellers and develops competing products. So what did you learn from this hearing? What laws, if any, could rein in tech giants? Join in 800-642-1234. Julia Angwin is editor-in-chief of The Markup, and she stays with us. Let's bring in a call now. Saeed is joining us from Green Bay this morning. Hi, Saeed.
Good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to respectfully disagree with Julia when she thought that the discussion of political censorship is not relevant to creating monopolies. What we were talking about is the Senate hearings were about was creating monopoly, economic monopolies, but also monopolies of ideas. And in the public discourse on an exchange, because of the strength of these platforms, if they have a particular political bias, they can result in diminishing from the public debate, in creating an atmosphere of monopolistic thinking. And in a world we live in right now with a cancel culture, where instead of listening to opposing points of view, we rather cancel them. And the example she brought up, the example of the video where a group of physicians were talking about hydroxychloroquine, and that was deemed false by whoever the censor was. And now your speaker refers to that as a falsehood.
Well, let's get Julia to respond here to the notion of the monopoly of ideas has weight in society.
I mean, it's a very good point. The truth is that these tech platforms do play an unbelievable and unprecedented role in governing speech around the world in a way that we've really never seen, right? They do have the ability to control the political discourse, right? If they determine something they don't want it to be said, they can zap it from their platforms, and they do. But that isn't what I meant to say is that that isn't traditionally an antitrust issue, right? That is an issue we haven't really figured out how to grapple with, but our antitrust laws are not really set up to deal with that particular issue. They're supposed to deal with economic harm. I think that there is a question of how do we deal with that issue, because we may or may not agree with any one of the decisions that the companies make about censoring content, but overall, the idea that they have more power than any government to decide what speech is allowed is something that is unprecedented in the world and a power that really we are all grappling with, every nation on this globe.
Well, let's hear an exchange. Here is U.S. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin questioning Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
Exactly what are your standards in, quote, filtering out political speech that maybe some people out there don't agree with?
Congressman, thank you for the opportunity to address this. Our goal is to offer a platform for all ideas. We want to give everyone in the world a voice to share their experiences and ideas. A lot of that is day-to-day things that happen in their lives. Some of it is political. And frankly, I think that we've distinguished ourselves as one of the companies that defends free expression the most.
So there's Zuckerberg, who is repeatedly questioned about how and when Facebook takes down posts. What do members of Congress want Facebook to do differently?
Well, the thing is that everybody wants something different from Facebook, right? So essentially what most people want is they want their views amplified and other people's views less amplified. And so it definitely varied across the aisle, right, in terms of what Democrats and Republicans were talking about. And it certainly varies in all sorts of groups, right? If you would talk to Black Lives Matter group, you would hear from them that they feel like their posts are being taken down all the time as well. And so there are complaints on all sides of the aisle here. And I think that the one thing that Facebook does deserve a little bit of credit for is being more transparent in recent years about what the rules are and sort of arguing in public about what those rules should be and whether to adjust them.
We're talking with Julia Angwin, editor-in-chief of The Markup. It's a nonprofit news outlet. We're looking at the congressional antitrust hearing this week involving big tech CEOs of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Getting your thoughts on the hearing as well. Is Congress equipped to handle tech companies? What type of regulation do you want to see? What were your takeaways from the hearing? We're at 800-642-1234. Julia, how does this effort by Congress and what they're doing in this investigation, how does that compare with the EU's, the European Union's approach to regulating tech companies?
Well, the EU has been really aggressive. They've been fining and investigating these companies much more aggressively in the recent years. This is really the US's first big stepping up to investigate these companies. And so I would say probably in some sense, it's worth thinking of this as a little bit of catching up with the EU. There have been multiple multi-billion dollar fines levied by the EU against tech companies. They've had reports on all sorts of different aspects of their business and forced changes. And so the US has been more accommodating to these companies, largely because they're based here and they create lots of jobs and innovation and growth in our economy. And so for a long time, Congress and U.S. government have been very hands off about regulating the internet. It's only now that we're seeing that tide turning.
You mentioned at the start that there could be down the path here a breakup or attempted breakup of these companies. What might that look like?
Yeah, it's hard to know what exactly. A lot of people have called for a lot of different things, but I think one of the things that comes up again and again is the idea that Facebook shouldn't have been allowed to buy Instagram and WhatsApp. Those acquisitions give it so much power over all the different ways that people message each other. And so that continues to come up, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that as a recommendation. In his closing remarks, the subcommittee chairman, David Cicilline, said, some of these companies need to be broken up and some of them need a lot more regulation. And so I could easily see a call for a breakup and also probably some sort of call for more regulation of some kind, which is hard to know what that would look like. Is that a new federal agency that regulates this whole sector or more rules that apply to them in existing agencies? Hard to know.
Where are consumer protections here? Where do the consumers come in with what Congress is probing?
Yeah, consumer protections are, meant to be enforced by the Federal Trade Commission and sometimes the CFPB, the Financial Bureau. But those agencies have both been hamstrung and underfunded and not able to pursue as much aggressive enforcement as they would like and as people think is needed in this sector. So I can imagine also that this report would likely call for stronger funding and support for those agencies to pursue more consumer protection.
I wonder if these CEOs, after the hearing, went back to their companies and say, hey, we got to fix this or do this or adjust here because we just got bombarded with some questions about this. Can you fix this here? Would they make any changes on their own, do you think?
I don't really think so. I feel like right now the bet is that these tech companies know that Congress is slow moving. We have an election coming up in November. Everything kind of depends on the outcome of that election, what the political winds are going to be. So if I was one of these CEOs, I would say let's wait and see where the political winds go next.
And so as this investigation goes on, what happens next? What is the next stage?
Well, the next thing is that the committee is going to issue a report, and that report is likely to be quite scathing. They've released, they've subpoenaed more than a million documents from these companies, and during the hearing and after the hearing, they released some of them, and some of them are, pretty damning, talking about quashing competition and, neutralizing their enemies and stuff like that. So I imagine this report is going to be pretty hard-hitting, and it's going to call for a lot of things to happen, but then it's a question of whether those things will happen, I think, will really depend on the political environment. And I suspect that we'll wait until after the presidential election.
So the last time Congress took on a tech company, it was Microsoft in the late 90s. Does this compare in any way?
Yes and no, right? The Microsoft case was a good one, but you know, ultimately that did play out in the courts, right? And that is what will have to happen here too. And that hasn't, none of that process has happened. There hasn't been any prosecutions. You know, you would have to see a Department of Justice case against one of these companies. And so I imagine the report from the subcommittee might help lay the groundwork. And actually, I'm sure it's designed to provide evidence for a case that could be brought, but we don't know yet whether any cases are being put together.
Julia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Julia Angwin is an investigative journalist and editor-in-chief of The Markup. It's a nonprofit newsroom investigating the impacts of technology on society. You can find a link to their reporting at wpr.org/mornings. Coming up, we look at how schools are reopening this fall and where federal money should go to support them. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Vice President Mike Pence and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos visited a private school in North Carolina this week to advocate for in-person instruction and to promote giving families options to all virtual coursework amid the pandemic. Schools across America are receiving federal emergency aid to help mitigate the costs of COVID-19. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty is leading a coalition of dozens of states to represent the interests of private schools in the distribution of that aid. How do you think funds should be distributed to public and private schools? Should schools that don't open for in-person instruction receive less federal aid? We're at 800-642-1234. Will Flanders is research director for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. It's an organization that advocates for constitutional government. Will, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's look at this case, Michigan versus DeVos, which is where the Institute has filed a friend of the court brief. And so really, this is coming down to how aid is being distributed to public and private schools. What does your brief argue?
That's right. So the argument here is that the federal government has decided through Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration that federal CARES Act money should go equitably to all schools, regardless of sector. We have in the United States today about 10% of kids that are educated in private schools. Here in Wisconsin, with all of our school choice programs, it's higher than that even. And we think that, you know, given that this crisis has affected schools across all sectors, whether you're a private school, a public school, a charter school, that money should be equitably distributed. So, you know, the number of students that are in private schools, the number of students that are in public schools, those factors should be taken into account, and the funds should be distributed in that manner. You know, there's a good deal of evidence that private schools do a solid job of educating students, at least in our choice programs here. We at least have some evidence that they may even do a better job in some circumstances. And we don't think those schools should be left out in the cold, particularly as we're seeing a rash of private school closures around the country.
Well, I don't know if they're being left out in the cold. Private schools are getting a distribution of this money. The CARES Act calls for giving this according to a formula, which is Title I, providing federal money to schools to help at-risk students, and private schools are eligible for Title I services. So what type of different formula do you see here that is compromising private schools?
Well, the question is there's lawsuits that have been filed by a number of attorneys general around the country, including Michigan as well as Wisconsin, that are making the argument that money should be used for public schools rather than for private schools specifically. So the argument that we're making here is in that lawsuit saying, no, that funding should include private schools. So sort of agreeing with the administration position rather than keeping it to public schools primarily.
Okay. So From your position, though, do you agree that when allocating the emergency aid from the federal government, that it should go to benefit vulnerable students first?
Oh, absolutely. And we've seen, you know, in Wisconsin, we've been big advocates for ensuring that Title I funds that are appropriately and equitably distributed in the past. We think that low-income students particularly have been suffering during the pandemic. Some other topics we'll discuss in the interview will touch on that as well. There's a growing amount of evidence that those students are sort of seeing the gap between themselves and their peers widen. So absolutely, we think Title I students and low-income students in general should be first in line.
You recently wrote an op-ed advocating for low-income families to get some of the CARES Act relief funding. How would this help schools better educate students?
Yeah, so this was more focused on the state issues. This was focused on state funding particularly, though there is the argument out there with our brief looking at federal funds. As we look at, you know, the state and districts making their own decisions about reopening, as I just mentioned, you know, we've seen that schools are struggling to get resources to parents sufficiently to make sure that education is continuing in a good manner. You know, that's understandable. We're not saying that, you know, necessarily schools are doing a bad job. It's very challenging during the pandemic. We conducted a poll earlier this year in which we asked parents, are you having to spend money on resources? Are you having to spend money on things to make sure that education occurs? And we found that 30% of parents say they're having to spend money on educational materials during the pandemic, and that low-income parents were more likely to say that they've had to spend money. They were also more likely to be dissatisfied with how education is going during the pandemic. So our argument is that if we're going to continue with virtual instruction in the fall, if we're going to continue with parents having to make time to, you know, work on the educational materials with their kids, to work through assignments more so than you would with a typical homework load, given that we're going to continue in that situation, at least in some districts, families should get some relief. I mean, some of the funding that's going to fund traditional schools at the moment should go directly to parents, potentially in the form of what's called an education savings account.
Okay, and so what type of money are you talking about?
So I think that's something that, you know, could be decided at a, you know, as we go through the process. What our poll found was that, you know, 9% of respondents said they'd spent more than $500. So there are some families out there that are having a large expenditure to probably purchase things like a laptop or a computer to make sure that their kids are able to complete their online coursework and things of that nature. But there are other things that could be used to help students that are falling behind to catch up. Those can include things like tutoring and, you know, supplemental resources online, things of that nature. The bottom line is that, you know, many parents don't have the time with work responsibilities to, you know, keep their kids moving forward to the extent that they could in a traditional classroom. So we think those supplemental resources, some portion of the aid, though, again, that could be determined as we go through the process, what would be appropriate that would allow some of those things to occur.
Talking with Will Flanders, Research Director for the Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty, looking at the Institute's stance on education and labor issues amid the pandemic, with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Dave is joining us from Fort Atkinson this morning. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well. What's on your mind here?
Well, you know, I got to say, you know, as a proud American, I'm a little bit offended, that's the best word I can come up with, about this discussion. There should be no question of public schools are the only place that should get any government aid. Private schools are private for a reason. Again, it's an American society. If you don't like the public schools, go to a private school, but you're not going to get any money from taxpayers. That's why it's private. So to me, this shouldn't even be a debate. There's a separation of church and state. I say that because a lot of private schools are not secular. They're religious in some way. They should get zero money from the state.
Will Flanders?
Yeah, thank you for your question there, Dave, or your comment. You know, our argument is that, you know, we've seen across the board that this is an unprecedented situation. This is not sort of a normal recession in the sense that, you know, you expect ups and downs in the economy. This has been a broad shutdown of the entire apparatus of education, as well as, you know, for many employers across the board. And, you know, given that to some extent that The government is telling us that this is the right approach, that the government is telling us that we should be continuing to shut down and utilize social distancing practices. Not saying that's a bad idea. It's a good idea. But this is something that's sort of outside of the bounds of the normal market forces. And in that case, I think it's reasonable to say that many businesses across the board have gotten some help, many in the form of loans that are to be paid back. And I think there's no reason that private schools that do educate, again, more than 10% of students in the country should be exempted from those sorts of things.
Well, let's take another call now. Steve is joining us from Sun Prairie this morning. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I don't believe federal dollars should be sent to any school that doesn't have in-school learning. I have friends up in Lodi, and I listened to their school board meeting the other night. And the lack of respect that's out there for parents and the view of children as just money-making for the school is just wrong. We need the federal government to step up and represent the taxpayers that are not being represented by the school unions and the board that is owned by those unions.
All right, Steve, bringing up unions here, Will Flanders, what are your insights there?
Yeah, so I think that's a great point. I think that, while on the individual level, absolutely many teachers care very much about their students, I think what we see when we get to the school board meetings and we see the unions, making their case, it's often forgotten about that these are real families that are struggling. Again, when you have young children, having to do home education may make it very hard for a family to go back to work and things of that nature. So I think that remembering that these are individual students, and we should be absolutely more concerned about what will provide students with the best education rather than what will make the district building function the best in the near future.
Well, Will, I'm wondering, in your research, have you looked at districts that have provided laptops to each student as they rolled out remote learning in the spring?
Yeah, we tried to get a look at a sort of a comprehensive look across the board at, what districts were doing. Given that we have over 400 districts in the state of Wisconsin, it's difficult to get a comprehensive picture. We did see wide variation in our poll in terms of whether parents were receiving the resources from the school that they needed. Some parents were, saying that they were absolutely satisfied and they were getting everything they needed from the school for them to be able to conduct home education adequately. Other districts, particularly some larger districts, there were some struggles in rolling out those resources. Now, granted, we did this poll early on and some things may have changed since then. There may be more resources available than there were earlier in the pandemic. But I think that it's probably the case throughout the state that there are some districts that have not adequately met the needs. And I suspect if we did another poll, we'd see similar percentages of parents that are dissatisfied.
We have Will Flanders of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty as we discuss education and labor issues and Will's stances amid the pandemic. The American Federation of Teachers said they'd support safety strikes by teachers if safety measures are not met when schools reopen. Should teachers walk out if they feel it's unsafe to gather in classrooms? What role do unions have in a pandemic? What funding does your school need to hold in-person instruction or to make remote learning productive? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in a minute with Will Flanders here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The head of the American Federation of Teachers told its members this week that it would support safety strikes if health precautions aren't met. But there's mounting political pressure because getting parents back to work requires functioning school systems. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty is leading a coalition of states representing the interests of private schools as federal aid is dispensed. It's looking into the complex pandemic-driven policy areas emerging around education, family, and labor issues. Teachers, how are you planning for the upcoming school year? Are you worried or encouraged by schools that are going all virtual. We're at 800-642-1234. Will Flanders is research director at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and he stays with us for 10 more minutes. Well, before we move on to our next topic here, I want to ask you on the issue of school funding and, you know, moving money around with this federal aid. Schools in the pandemic have become a lifeline for food. They've become a lifeline for families who are struggling to have enough money to pay their rent, their, you know, in terms of getting their internet connection. They've been a lifeline for health for these families, to getting medical care. So when you cut back on the aid to these schools, what happens there as these schools are trying to get their kids connected with resources?
Yeah, so great question. I think, you know, we've absolutely seen many schools step up and serve as a great sort of central community resource. I think none of this is to take that away. I think the idea here is that for some of those services, you know, we may effectively be cutting out the middleman by directly funding families. But no discussions really involve, you know, completely taking away funding. You know, many of us in the private sector have had employment cutbacks, have had furloughs, have had job loss. So essentially during this time of a, you know, bad economic situation coupled with a pandemic, many across the board have had to take a pay cut and suffered to some extent. I think there's no reason we shouldn't think that government entities should have to do the same thing. And by funding families directly and cutting out the middleman, I think that some of those can be even more effectively carried out.
Well, let's look at the mask order starting tomorrow. Governor Evers issued the order requiring people to wear face masks indoors. The statewide mandate taking effect tomorrow. Your president, Rick Essenberg, responded by saying that the governor lacked the legal authority to do this. What do you see there?
Yeah, so I think the question here, and I definitely should put the caveat here that I'm one of the non-lawyers at Will. So, you know, I think the lawyers will have a better informed perspective. I'm just a lowly PhD here. But I think the debate here is on, you know, can the governor create a new emergency order that extends beyond the 60 days of his original order? So the Constitution says the governor can only create an emergency order for a certain period of time. What he's done here is sort of craft a new order that would put new mandates in place with the mask requirements. Obviously, we can all agree that wearing a mask can be helpful, and it is it's the right thing to do for your fellow man to sort of so we can get over this pandemic and get back to life in a normal way. But I think there's an argument for doing these things at a more local level. And there is, in fact, just basic legal principle of whether or not this can be a legal order. So that's what our lawyers are looking into right now. And I'm sure you'll hear more from us in the near future on that topic.
What do masks have to do with courts? Like, how did masks become... Masks are a public health issue. What does this have to do with politics?
Yeah, so I think it's unfortunate that the mask argument has really become politicized. I think the sort of conflicting messages that happened early on from the CDC and the federal level have led some people to think that maybe there isn't good evidence that masks are effective. I think when I look at the evidence, I think the evidence suggests that masks are likely to be effective. But I think the legal question here is more on whether this is in the governor's powers to create a new emergency order, and not so much on whether masks are effective or not. While that's important and you know, something we should consider, I think the legal question is more about the principle of allowing emergency orders to be put into place without the consent of the legislature.
Okay, so if you're the governor, what are you supposed to do here? You see a rising spike in cases throughout the month of July. We're at the last day here. What would you suggest the governor do?
So I think the way that things are supposed to work in state government is the governor is, you know, supposed to work with the state legislature on these things, and both parties have to be willing. You know, I think the legislature in general is happy with setting things at the local level, and I think in many ways that's more sensible. We have areas in the state that are having significant outbreaks. We have other areas of the state where things are pretty calm, where things are not really increasing to any large extent. So allowing a more nuanced approach, I think, is what the state legislature seems to prefer. I don't want to speak on behalf of anyone here. But the way that our constitutional government is supposed to work is that the governor works with the state legislature to create these things rather than sort of creating by fiat executive orders, essentially, or emergency orders.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Will Flanders, who is with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, research director there, talking about the Institute's stance on education, masks, labor policy, courts amid the pandemic, getting your thoughts as well on these issues. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Al now in Westfield. Hi, Al.
Hi. I had a question. Given that Wisconsin is testing about 7%, if you reopen schools in a class of 30, you're going to have about two students with COVID, and those students are going to pass it to the teachers if you reopen schools. Those teachers aren't all in their 20s and 30s. Some are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. Therefore, a good number of them are going to die if you reopen schools. What is the caller's response to that?
Will, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, so great question. I think that we have to take into account the individual characteristics of teachers. Just as we've seen, you know, for example, with baseball coming back, everyone's had an opportunity to opt out on their own. And I think that if you're in a high-risk category, if you're an older teacher, if you're someone with a number of comorbidities, I think there absolutely should be an opportunity for an opt-out. I think there are many teachers. I believe the average age in the state of teachers is 34. So there are a good number of teachers that are in the younger age range that in general, you know, with the caveat of in general, you know, there are people out there with comorbidities at a younger age, but in general are in better health and at a low risk of contracting or of having serious consequences from the virus.
What do you mean by opt out? Like, what do you mean by that?
So I think there could be the potential that given if it's a small number of teachers in a particular district, to let them not work for the year, to set them up in one of the sort of virtual roles that probably will be required to some extent throughout this process, to sort of make it work for the short term for those that are in those high risk categories. Because I think given the younger age on average of teachers, it's likely to be a small number. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have compassion for those folks that are in a high risk category.
You've spoken about how, you know, the issue around unions and policing in the country, you know, after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. You made the case for Act 10 style reform to the police union. What would this achieve?
Yeah, so as we looked in the aftermath of the tragic death of George Floyd, what we saw is that there were a number of reforms that were proposed throughout the country. Many like defunding the police to some extent. The extent to which they meant actually defunding is certainly varies depending on who you discuss it with. But we thought that one reasonable approach is that, you know, originally when Act 10 was passed, police officers unions were left out of the legislation. And what that means is that police unions still exercise a great deal of power in the state of Wisconsin, as well as around the country in general. What that leads to is it makes it more difficult for investigations to take place. It means that officers that are not doing a great job often can stay on the force for a longer period, as there's a disincentive towards investigation. We've seen officers in other parts of the country fighting body cameras through the union and things like that. So while we think most officers are doing a great job, if we're looking for ways that we can cull those bad apples from the workforce, we think Act 10 style reform applied to the police force could be an effective means of achieving that goal.
Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Will Flanders, research director for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. It's an organization advocating for constitutional government. Just ahead, we go on an adventure with the author of Opal Watson, a detective who solves mysteries. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.